This is Dave Burkitt, recorded at his home in Nettleham, Lincolnshire, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 6th of May 2010. Dave Burkitt, Part 2. So you were back in Britain and itching to go, well, sort of itching to go south again. And how did the opportunity arise to go back? For this will be the second time you've been, we're talking about now. You've been there for 2.5 years and then came the opportunity to go back. So what happened to draw you back to the Antarctic second time?
I wanted to go back, certainly. Yeah, I applied. I approached Bass and said, any chance of any GA's job down south again? And if possible, I'd like to go GA'ing at South Georgia. And so that was it. Yeah, they took me on. So it wasn't a matter of, oh, I'm out of work. Oh, is it worthwhile going? It's been a fantastic time, the whole of my time with Bass, and every time I look back on it and think, great. And there were tremendous times, and so I was very much looking forward to going south again. And, I approached Bass, and there I was in South Georgia again.
By choice?
By choice, very much so, yeah.
What were you doing?
I went down the next time, that second time, as a field GA, doing geological work. Prior to that, they'd done fair bit of geology had gone on in South Georgia, but no real inland trips, venturing really up the glaciers and so on. It had all been fairly coastal work. And my first field season then was very nice, hell of a nice guy, Brian Story, who's now incidentally head of geology New Zealand. But with Brian, we went, lovely Irishman, we went down, again on the John Biscoe. We were dropped off in the field on the southeastern end of South Georgia with a view to exploring inland right up the glaciers. There are some big glaciers there.
This was in 1976?
76, yeah, it'd be about that, yeah. 70, yeah, it was, yeah. So we got dropped off and with about 4 months' supplies, and there we were again. And my job was to plane table and assist Brian in every way I could do. And Brian is one of these revving guys, really wanting to go for it, quite an adventure himself. And everywhere we had the old 1 to 200 thou Duncan Cast map, which is pretty good. I mean, it's still very good. And Bass has now produced much better maps, but it was very good. And we travelled around, and I made my own plane table map as we were progressing inland and up the glaciers.
What's
and
a
so
plane
on.
Table map, sorry.
A plane table map is a very basic form of map making. You simply have a horizontal board table. You set it up as level as you can do. You set yourself up a station, your main station. You measure out a baseline, and you ping a ray out drawn on the map on the white paper. From where you are to where this second survey station is, you measure it out and you set your scale up accordingly. You do a line on there, and then by means of triangulation, you ping out rays looking through this instrument called an alidade, a simple little instrument laid on the plane table. You ping out onto different features, rock pinnacles and so on. You put a mark where, or draw a line through, then you go to your second point, you intersect, and where the intersection is, so and you build up your map as you go along.
And have you learnt that on the job, so to speak?
I'd done a bit of plane tabling on the Elephant Island expedition with the services, and then I'd very much improved on that working down at Stonington with Dave Singleton, a geologist at Stonington, and I produce all his large scale maps, and it is very satisfying, very rewarding work. You know, you're seeing your map progress. And this was the days, of course, before GPS and satellite imagery and everything else. And it is quite interesting now to look at my map, which I made by a plane table, compared with the modern satellite compile maps. And
do they match?
Yeah, pretty good, yeah. Yeah, so it is very rewarding work.
How does it feel to be mapping out a piece of land that nobody actually has mapped before?
Well, that's
it. Are you taming the land, or...?
I don't know about taming it, but it is rewarding work, and it's exciting work, and you're wanting it to be as accurate as possible. And I certainly put a lot of effort and time into it. You know, if I knew I'd gone wrong somewhere, trying to work out where and how. But seeing that bit of paper, that map on the bit of paper, slowly building up. It really is. It's exciting work. And so that was what I found. It was great to be with a geologist doing that sort of work.
There's a hint here that 76 was your best winter, your best season, I should say.
My most enjoyable, yeah. At South Georgia, insofar as we were kept very busy, great crowd of blokes, the great crowd of blokes everywhere, of course, but it was a good crowd of blokes on base. We did an awful lot. Was it 76? I think it might have been the following season, actually, when I was BC, and I look back on that year as being my best, my most enjoyable, my most satisfying. We did all sorts of things on base, you know, entertainment, but everybody got on well with the work, or most of us did. We put in a lot of effort. All the buildings at King Edward Point were all painted. We did a lot of maintenance work on base. Everybody worked hard in that respect, and it was great. And then at the weekend, we had all sorts of jollying. We had our own ski tow. We had water skiing in the cove. I'm sure as the risk assessment, health and safety thing would probably pull the hair out these days. But, you know, we did it, and we had a great time.
So you became base commander at South Georgia,
yeah.
The following year, 77, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Thereabouts. Tell me about that, because that was a step up, wasn't it? And perhaps something you hadn't necessarily been expecting.
Well, I was. In fact, I did say to Ricky Chin or whoever, I said, Ricky, can I be base commander this year? I did, you know, I genuinely wanted the challenge. And
you dropped a hint.
I did, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I was appointed base commander, and it did go well, but, you know, some of it, you look back on it and think, well, and when you do get, when something is amiss, you know, I did lose a lot of sleep over one particular...
Well, tell me a bit about what would cause you sleepless nights.
Well, we had an individual on base who I felt I knew wasn't pulling his weight. And he was supposed to be working with another guy doing, you know, for a week's project up the glacier, whatever. And after a couple of days, they were back down again. This went on and on. In the end, we had to replace this guy using base personnel to go and do his job and so on. And so, in turn, you inform Cambridge of what's going on. Tells going backwards and forwards, the old cryptic message, using the coding system and so on. And when you're to tell, you have, you know, saying to someone, look, resign or you will be sacked, it's, I lost a lot of sleep over it. And, you know, I was probably in my mid, late 20s then. And you think, am I doing the right thing? Deep down, I thought I knew that, knew he wasn't pulling his weight, but. So yeah, it was a responsible job, and I'm sure a lot of us have felt the same way. Some of us, but having said that, it was great. Now, it was quite rewarding, and it's good to look at a base ticking over and seeing everybody enjoying themselves and people getting on with the work and so on.
How many people were there that about that time?
I think about 28 of us. Something
so
like
is
that.
It Wouldn't quite it? Is it quite lonely then being the base leader, base commander?
No, I don't think it is. It's not like you're in a situation, say, the likes of, you know, again, we keep talking about this man, the likes of the Shackleton Scott experiences, those sort of things, where you've got these life-making decisions to make. It's not like that at all. And, it was a little bit more remote, certainly, than what it is now, you know, with internet and everything else, access straight to Cambridge. But... nonetheless, I wouldn't say it certainly wasn't lonely. I mean, I socialised just the same as everybody else, and apart from the one incident where we had, talking about before, apart from that, it all went very well, and everybody got on well, and I used to enjoy a drink just the same as everybody else.
There's a story to do with a doctor, or the lack of doctor at South Georgia at this point in time, when you a story about a party, apparently. Which I have to ask you about.
Yeah, well, a party. We had several parties. Well, I'm sure you parties did. Every weekend. Yeah. But, there wasn't a doctor on base. So I, as base commander, acted as, looked after the medical side of things. And, in fact, my room, we all had our own rooms at Shackleton House, which were totally different than all the other bases at the time in the 70s. And right next door to me was the surgery. I did deal with two or three incidents, stitching people up and so on. But I do remember that one time we'd had a big, as usual, Saturday night party, and I'd gone to bed, whatever time it was, midnight, in the early hours of the morning. One of the lads came to give me a shake and said, "Dave, can you give us a hand? Mex has had an accident." So
Mex
Merson, his name was. Sadly, Mex is no longer with us, but he's a great character again. The Met Man, meteorologist. And anyway, Mex, bless him, had fallen off the bar stool and fallen backwards, and behind the bar is the bar store with a door in it. He'd fallen there, and I don't quite to this day know exactly how it happened, but somebody the other side had tried to slam the door to, and poor old Max had caught it, had got his hand laid out there, more or less unconscious on the deck, and all his fingers on one hand were smashed and bleeding, and it was a bit of a mess. Anyway, they brought him up to me. I said, OK, bring him up. And I knew more or less what sort of state he'd be in. And brought him up and into the surgery there. And I got the local anaesthetic out and stuck the needle into his fingers. It was no problem at all doing that. Let me and he anaesthetised his three digits. And then I got the needle and thread out and tried to stitch him up. And he wouldn't have any of that. Arms flailing and got a bit punchy, a bit stormy. So yeah, I just said, "Put the bugger to bed." He woke up next morning with his hand all sticking to the sheet, and still scarred right the way through, I think, through the rest of his life from that incident. But yeah, you're right. We didn't have a doctor on base, unlike nowadays. I think all the bases have got doctors on. But that there was that case, another case where a guy had slipped on a scree and torn palm of his hand open, stitched that up. Generally speaking, you know, it's only minor things like that. Everybody is in a pretty good state of health when they're down there.
What was Shackleton House like then? Was it a cut above the rest as far as...
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, it was totally different than the norm of a FIDS base, certainly, in that it was built actually for... about the mid-1920s, the British government, or Falkland Islands government, set up what they call the Discovery Investigations, which was named after Captain Scott's ship, the Discovery, and they were investigating the whaling industry around the South Georgia and down the Antarctic. Anyway, the Discovery Investigations, they put this building up on King Edward Point, where the British administration was, called Discovery House. It's now a listed building on the point, and to house the laboratories and so on. Well, Discovery House had become at the end of its days, and they, Falkland Islands government, then built what is called Shackleton House. Discovery Investigations finished. The Falkland Islands had no need for it, and they asked the British Antarctic Survey to take over the administration and set up a scientific laboratory. So the obvious place for us to go was to use Shackleton House. And in the this is in the late 60s, I think, and... So we took it over, and it was a lovely building. I mean, it really was like a hotel. There was even talk of when Bass were pulling out to convert it, the Falkland Island government, to convert it into a hotel for tourists. It probably worked well now. Alas, that building has now been taken out. But in the 70s, when we were using it, right up until the Falklands War, in fact, when the Argentines invaded South Georgia, it was still used by Bass. And, OK, it had seen better days, and they were talking then about replacing it. But it was a lovely building, two-storey building. We all had our own bunk little bedrooms, not quite en suite, but three or four bathrooms on the upper deck, and a nice bar, a lovely big kitchen, lovely big dining room. One lad had built, Bob Clunas, the chippy had... Or boatmen had built this lovely big dining room, went the full length of that room. That must have been about 30 foot long or so, is that table, out of this lovely 2-inch timber. Anyway, it was a lovely building, had a lovely library, everything else, you know, the whole lot. It was great. And must have been that you got up in the morning, went down into the dining room, sat there, a lovely big long window facing due south, straight out onto... what must be one of the finest views of any hotel in the world. You know, you're looking out on the Paget, the the Allardyce range of mountains, Mount Paget, Mount Root, Mount Nordenskjold Peak, and so on. So to sit there and look out over the water at these mountains, it was a real, well, it was a real pleasure, a real treat.
So you really got into a pattern then of doing the winters back here and the summers down south, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Was this a rolling contract, or did he have to keep reapplying? What happened?
Oh, it's...
Or was it just a gentleman's agreement?
Well, yeah, it's just a matter of get on the phone and Richard Hansen or Eric Salmon in those days, whoever it was, the personnel officer, just say, any chance of any work this season? What have you got going? And say, well, we've got an interesting field project, so on, you know, James Ross Island or wherever, down the peninsula, do you fancy it? So, yeah,
what were the highlights of that period in your life? What were the two or three key moments or key
projects? They were all highlights whenever I was in South Georgia. I had a couple of interesting geology trips there, and then a good season on James Ross Island, doing geological work, James Ross Island, which is the northeastern end of the Antarctic Peninsula. Had a very interesting glacio trip, my first real skidooing days, travelling across the bottom end of the Antarctic Peninsula and ending up in King George's Sixth Sound. So they're all good trips. They're all interesting, certainly quite varied. But, you know, South Georgia is an absolutely magic place to work. And they didn't ask me to go back, actually. I did two seasons there. I wonder why. But that first season there with Brian's story, I mentioned before, Brian, God, he's a hell of a worker, and he really did some, in quite bad condition at the time, really did some good work and collected some good samples, and we were down on the beach awaiting a pickup, and we were in the tent at night, and we got turned in, and we'd shifted gear ready for a pickup, not right by the water's edge, but a little bit closer closer down to the beach where we were due for pickup. In the middle of the night, suddenly the tent was, there was this roaring sound. The tent was moving about. We were on our lilos and we could feel we were afloat, and the tent was being dragged back down the beach. Anyway, we ripped the door open, and there in front of us, this slight wall of white water. It was amazing. And poor old Brian virtually lost everything, lost all his rock samples. We lost a load of scientific kit. We dragged everything back we could do, we could find back up the beach. But it was quite an epic. And, you know, it was a bit of a survival thing. We actually nobbled one of the old Gentoo penguins over the head too. We were eating that semi-raw because we didn't have the fuel to cook it with properly. And eventually we got picked up by the ship. Interestingly, Duncan Carse, who did all the mapping in the 1950s there, Duncan Carse had a solo expedition to a similar part of the coastline, that southeastern part of South Georgia, and he'd got washed away by a big storm, and nobody believed him. Anyway, I think after our incident, well, people thought, well, old Duncan Carse might have been right after all, you know.
Do you know what the cause was?
It was just a very, very big sea running. I mean, we hear these things with tidal waves and everything else. It was a particularly big sea and one particular big wave. It wasn't a tsunami or anything like that, not to my knowledge anyway. So it was just particularly bad weather, but it was quite an experience. So poor O'Brien lost everything. The following season, I went back again. They asked me if I'd go back again and repeat the work with another geologist, Bruce Mayer. So I said, yeah, OK, fine. We went back, worked the same area, making sure we didn't camp in the same place. Having said that, in our defence, we weren't camped in a silly place. We were 80 yards beyond the normal high tide mark. You know, we couldn't have got back any further. We were right beneath these cliffs and so on. Anyway, I went back the following year with Bruce Mayer and repeated all the work. And at the end of the season, we were waiting for a pickup. We were in the field for getting 3-4 months or whatever, waiting for a pickup. And the seas were particularly bad again. And Bransfield was due to pick us up. Stuart Lawrence, the captain, radioed me, and they'd put the boats out. And I said, look, the weather's not really pick up now. It had been a few hours previous. But anyway, they got the boats back on board. And We waited the following day, and they couldn't pick us up. And then the next day, and Stuart Lawrence radioed and said, I can't wait any longer. What are you going to do? I said, well, all we can do then tomorrow is depot everything, and we'll ski overland just with our own personal belongings, and you pick us up in a place called Drygalski Fjord, which is the old whalers used to use, Drygalski and Larsen Harbour. Very well, relatively sheltered area. So we skied overland the next day, and the ship picked up from the south of the glacier. I've got some interesting memories of that those field seasons on South Georgia.
How did you get on with the skidoos? Because you were doing your first skidoo trips in these little escapades as well, weren't you?
Yeah, we never used skidoos on South Georgia. We did use them. I beg your pardon. We did do one season. We had a skidoo to assist us on some work over on what is called the Bath Peninsula. And I don't normally talk a lot about that. It's a bit embarrassing, but I was working with this vet, Nigel Leader-Williams, doing some reindeer work, and we'd gone over to... we were going over to this hut way over the other side of the Bath Peninsula. And in the process, when we set off to go there, it was quite a lot of awkward travel up little gullies and so on. And I'd capsized the skidoo. Anyway, we got the skidoo upright again. I tried starting the damn thing. It would not start at all. I could not get it started. This was really my first experience with the skidoo. Anyway, it wouldn't start, so I said to Nigel, well, we'll backpack stuff over there. We'd already taken one load over, incidentally, so our personal gear was over at this hut. So we walked over and spent one of the coldest nights I've ever spent in Antarctica down there, huddled by this little tilly lamp for the night. We eventually came back the next day to see this dead skidoo and had a look at it. And what had happened, of course, the kill the engine button had been locked. That's all it was. I freed that and it started first pull. So a bit embarrassing. But that was... I did subsequently have... several skidoo trips, one on James Ross Island, another one traversing the peninsula, and they were very successful. And it was Dick Laws, of course, who said we should go over to mechanised transport. Doggy men, of course, their attitude was, well, with dogs, you know, you've got 30-odd feet of dogs out front pulling the sledge, they're your crevasse probe, and if you've got a good leader, it will avoid crevassing and so on. Whereas a skidoo, of course, you're sitting on top of your own crevasse probe. So that was a big concern. And indeed, in the early days from Rotherhithe, there was a fatality with a couple of lads killed on a skidoo. But the system is very good now. It's a good proved system where they link the skidoo, sledge together, roped up. And we used that as well when I was working on these places. And it did work very well. It's a very good system. And the reality is, compared with dogs, you know, dogs, you're feeding them every day regardless. If you have a long light period, you're not going to go out and feed the skidoos. You can travel much, much greater distances in a go on a skidoo compared with dogs. I mean, skidoos, we travel 50, 60, 70 miles in a day. So it is a much more efficient way of travelling. But not as romantic, of course. I mean, you go outside your tent in the morning when you've had a bit of a, not a barney, but, you know, inevitably on a long summer field trip with you working with one guy for several months on end. As youngsters, you do fall out. Not fall out, but big punch-ups or anything, but silly things where you're just fed up with each other's company, whatever, and you can go out and you can talk to your dogs. You know, as soon as the other guy's cleared off to do his day's work, you go around all your dogs in turn and chat to them and so on. It's great, and I'm sure everybody would agree with me there. Whereas you go outside, of course, in a skidoo and you start talking to that, well, things are going wrong then. But you know, it is it had to happen, and they are being used very successfully now.
Let's move into the 1980s, if we may, because there's an episode which says here 1982 in which you were talking to Dick Laws and trying to persuade him to let you fly home to Cambridge.
That's right.
So what's the story there? What is it, 82?
Was it
82?
It was 82, yeah. The Falklands War.
What's the story?
Well, that was the season I'd had on James Ross Island with Alistair Crane, geologist, and we had a very successful season, a very good one. And we got picked up by the... we did some Ooh, we did some geological landings by helicopter from HMS Endurance. She was down there. And then right at the end of the season, Bransfield came in, picked us up. We went from there up to the Falklands. And I've got a number of friends in the Falklands, one of whom knows all the Fitz, knew all the Fitz. She's dead now, but Velma Malcolm. And I went up to see Velma, and I probably stayed there. I think I did stay there a couple of nights with her while the ship was in. Anyway, Velma kept saying, "Oh, the Argies are going to invade." And I said, "No, no, it won't happen. They won't do." Anyway, we left there. But by then, on the Bransfield, Hugh O'Gorman was the radio op, and he was quite a one old Hugh was, quite a character. And he was, I think he even put a couple of wind-up signals on the FIDS notice board but about what was going on. But people could sense something was amiss, and there were all this talk about the scrap metal men and things. Anyway, it was starting to happen. And for whatever reason, Dick Laws was on board with us, and I said to him, "Dick, any chance of flight?" We were going from Falklands down to Punta Arenas. So I said to Dick, "Any chance of flying home with you? I've done the voyage, God knows how many times now, and I'd rather just get home rather than..." He said, "Yeah, no problem at all." And so that was it. We went into Punta Arenas, and about half a dozen of us flew out of Punta. We went from Punta Arenas up to Santiago across to... across to Buenos Aires, and then we got an international flight from BA to up to back to London, back to UK. And I can remember at the time we were delayed in Buenos Aires International Airport for several hours, 6, 8, I can't remember. And they wouldn't give us a reason. Nobody knew what was happening. But anyway, we eventually got out, and I got back to UK, and the following day, the following evening, the Argentines had invaded the Falklands, and I was listening my... television, I was listening to it all the time. I actually wept. I thought, "God, I don't believe this." So that was that.
Why was it emotional for you?
Well, it was very emotional, and I shed a tear. I thought, "Gosh, Velma had said the Argentines are going to invade," and I thought, "No, they won't do. But I had a lot of friends by then in the Falklands, and the whole business was. I can remember when the Belgrano was sunk, and going down to our local that night, and there was all these young lads in there shouting and cheering and everything else. I just walked out. It was, the loss of life and everything else.
Can you tell me a bit more about Velma's worries? What was making her feel that way?
Well, I think for some time they'd talked about it. There'd been rumours going around the Argentines had intended invading. And you read the history books now, there was intelligence going backwards and forwards and so on. So they got an inkling that something was happening.
The Falklanders were aware of this?
I think they were, yeah. Well, certainly Velma was. She says, those are her words. The Argies are going to invade. And no, they won't, Velma. He'd be all right. So clearly things were happening several months before the invasion.
You see, here in Britain, it all came as a big surprise. And yet you're not the first person to have been aware of the possibility of an invasion weeks before it happened.
Yeah, well, I wasn't part of it. I didn't know certainly what was going on board HMS Endurance. We worked with the captain very closely, Nick Barker, lovely man, old Nick. On HMS Endurance when we're doing the helicopter landings, geology landings, and he in his book about the Falklands invasion says that he was sending signals back, and I don't doubt this, the effect that the Argentines had, and he'd as good as been told, I think, that by a naval colleague in somebody who'd been at Dartmouth with or something like that in his younger days, who he'd entertained on board, saying, we intend invading the Falklands. And there was all those sort of rumours, things going around. But certainly...
So he was being told this by an Argentinian?
Well, apparently, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Dick Laws is very interesting on this point. He picked up, in the Buenos Aires Yacht Club, he was warned that there was going to be a task force, an Argentinian task force. And he went and told the British Embassy in Buenos Aires, and he was waved away.
Really? Yeah, those sort of things were happening, and you think, well, the the authorities, the British authorities and that were, well, were turning... and these signals about, of course, the Endurance. Reading through my own reports, I've written, you know, my journey reports and so on, saying, if HMS Endurance is down next season, these are some guidelines as to working with the helicopters and so on. And so then, obviously, I was aware that HMS Endurance was scheduled to be taken out, and that these signals were getting, you know, the Argentines were getting these signals that say Endurance had been no longer coming down, Britain's not interested.
So once the Falklands War had happened, you actually didn't go back for quite some time, is that right? When was your next trip south after the Falklands conflict?
It was quite a... It was several years.
What were you doing in the meantime?
I'd worked... I'd drifted into the building trade. I bought an old cottage in the village and I renovated that. And at the time I was getting paid... there were good... loans to be made on doing renovating old properties, you know, for... Anyway, I made a bit of money by buying several old properties and doing them up myself. And I thought, well, this is as good as earning money with... I was quite enjoying it. Of course, I'd got a steady girlfriend then and so on. So I didn't want to go back for... And I can't... It was a number of years, anyway.
What enticed you about to go back again then?
Probably because I'd broken up with a girlfriend anyway.
You went back to Rotherhead this time, didn't you?
Yeah, I think I was, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I had a couple of seasons down at Rotherhead, a bit of field work, and and quite enjoyed it.
According to this, you were opening up Damoy for the Airbridge South.
That's right, yeah.
Using Twin Otters and then the Dash 7.
Yeah.
What can you remember of that part of your life?
Well, in fact, that particular season was the very last time Damoy Point was used as a runway strip. The idea was the old John Biscoe, not being so powerful, couldn't get down to Rothera for relief. So they had this set up this quite a comfortable hut at a place called Damoy Point. Excuse me. And the aircraft, Twin Otters, would do fly up from Rothera. We'd man the base there and give them the weather. They'd fly up. The ship would drop off people at Damoy Point, and I think that Damoy had about 16 or 18 bunks in there. We had also Stormhaven tents outside, and it was quite a transit camp, really, a transit community when built up when the ship had dropped off a load of people and the weather wasn't flyable. So we were staying there at the point, then giving them weather, the aircraft would fly up, pick people and equipment up, ferry them down there. So that time I was there was the very last season it was used, quite successfully. But then the James Clark Ross was coming down the following season, a more powerful ship. And so the place was closed up, and that was it.
So let's go then forward now in time, if you can, to the 1990s, when you were, I'm not quite sure how this happened, but the whole project to rebuild and restore Port Lockroy arose. And what tell me about the decision there. What happened? Why was Port Lockroy chosen for restoration? How did it happen?
Yeah, it was about 1994-95. Ian Collins, who was head of logistics, taken over from Ricky Chin. Ian Collins and himself and a chap called Chris Cochrane, a New Zealand conservation architect, they came south or went south on, I can't remember which ship, but they did the round of as many of the abandoned British bases as they could down the peninsula. Chris Cochrane did a survey of them all. And from that, they had this slight league table as to which bases would be best conserved, because at the time, the British Antarctic Survey, or Britain as signatory to the Antarctic Treaty, is obliged, as are all other nations, supposedly, to clean up the mess we've left in the past. So it was decided that some of these bases would be retained as historic sites and monuments per the Antarctic Treaty, on a par with... the historic sites in the Ross Sea. So they did this report. Port Lacroix, Base A, which was the original, the oldest of the remaining British bases, that was priority over any of the other bases. They had this league table of points for accessibility, points for the state of building, point, and so on. Amount of scientific work there, and so Lacroix was top of the list, albeit it was in the worst condition. So it was top priority to get it done. So that was about 1994-95. And then I was down there that season and talking to Richard Hansom, who was personnel officer, and said, did I fancy organising a team to clean that up? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. It'd be an interesting project. And because I knew a bit about the base and so on. And I did say to Richard, I said, provide I can have my own team, mm-hmm. because the clean-up, we were already doing clean-up jobs in those days, but the form it took was people going out of, say, Rotherhithe or Halley or wherever. Oh, do you fancy a jolly for a couple of weeks at such and such a base? Do a clean-up. Well, they weren't interested in, you know, and so anybody was taken in there. So I said, well, yeah, provided we can have a professional team to do the job, yeah. So anyway, I had my pick and I recruited a team, and there were five of us, including Chris Cochrane, the conservation architect, went in the in 96 season. And I'd ordered all the materials and everything to be shipped down on HMS Endurance. We went down, we joined Endurance in Punta Arenas, and we got ashore. We had to wait right until the end of the to the back end of the season, because the breed there is a quite a big breeding colony of Gentoos there, and we were conscious of the cruise ships. Also, Port Lacroix is right in the hub of the Antarctic cruise ship scene, you know, down the Neumeier Channel, the Gaelash Strait and the Bismarck Strait and so on. So it's right in the hub of it, and we were conscious of the tourists going in, and there'd been all these complaints, and rightly so, by many tourists and people saying, what the hell's that place up there falling apart and filthy condition, rusty oil drums. So we had to do something about it anyway. So we went in. And everybody, I think, at the end of the season was very surprised about the amount of work we had achieved. It was, you know, in 6 weeks, it had totally transformed the place, put on all new roofing felt and so on. And it did look good, and we were all well pleased with what we'd achieved.
Was tourism the real purpose?
No, it wasn't the real purpose. It was, but it did have a... that there had, as I say, been a number of complaints going to the Foreign Office, to the United States Department, and, you know, from tourists going in and saying, what the hell, you know, that place there was filthy. And it really was. It was disgraceful the way we'd left a base like that. But there was no environmental policy when we closed those bases down, no waste disposal policy or anything. All the gas went out the back door. And that was the situation. So
the biggest challenge in clearing it up, what was the biggest problem?
Well, the big problem wasn't really the cleaning up of the litter. The big problem, the big part of it, was getting the place waterproof and weatherproof and re-roofing and everything else. But, you know, just the four of us in there, we all got stuck in. And, you know, the lads really were... We were working 7 days a week, and any decent weather, sometimes 15, 16, 17 hours a day, whatever. We were on the go all the time. We got the work done. We filled up all these gas drums. Everything we didn't use, all the waste had to be shipped out. And it was a very successful project.
And did you then run it for a while as well?
Yeah, I did, yeah. whilst we were doing the work, we had a number of yachts came in, for example, and I remember one particular yacht which had just been to Palmer Station round the corner, the American base, and they said, oh, you could run this place like Palmer Station, have your gift shop and everything else. So over that time, these ideas were coming together about what we should do. So at the end of the season, I wrote my report and suggested, look, we will have to, have to keep an eye on the place, because there's so many tourists now interested in what's going on, what we're doing here, and they're all landing, and inevitably doors are going to be left open and so on. So the place does need to be checkups made on it periodically, a couple of times a season, whatever. And we'd also came up with this idea of reopening the post office and a small gift shop to pay for itself. So that's what was what happened. We had the meeting at the end when I got back, and the Antarctic Heritage Trust people were invited along. And from there, the whole thing took off. And that first season, we had a few T-shirts and sweatshirts, whatever, to not particularly well designed or thought up, but it did pay for itself, the season. Bass provided the logistics for it. We had a meeting at the end of every season, and slowly but surely the Antarctic Heritage Trust, the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust, has taken it over. And so now they are, they've taken full responsibility from Bass for the running of the base, and it's now their flagship, as they say.
You sold me a postcard in the year 2000, which is still on my wall today.
Good.
Which I posted from Port Lockroy. I nearly missed my ship. They were slow in writing the postcard. What was it like then being postmaster of Port Lockroy, the southernmost postmaster in the world?
Right? I enjoyed it. Well, I really did.
Postmaster.
Yeah, it was a great time. I really did. I got an awful lot out of it. It was great, and I'm glad I did it then. I wouldn't want to be doing it now.
Why not?
It's far too busy now. To the extent that I think it's probably getting a little bit out of hand. But anyway, I'm not not a lot to do with it.
Well,
now.
I was going to ask you about your feelings about tourism in the Antarctic. So, having done it, having been on the receiving end, what is your feeling?
I'm all for it, as they always say. They use this phrase, "Oh, ambassadors for the Antarctic," and so on. Which I think there's something in it, in that. But I was down there, 96, 97 season. We saw these ships coming in, and all the yachties as well. And I built up a great relationship with all these people, and got to know all the expedition staff, and I was impressed with them, and the tourists are well behaved. Obviously you get a few misdemeanours, but generally speaking, it works very well, and they're well controlled, and people find it interesting, and I'm sure they do go back and say, look, let's keep Antarctica pristine and all this sort of thing. So I am all for it. It has certainly, since the breakup of the Soviet Union days, when there were just a handful of ex-Russian ships doing the thing. There are now more and more cruise ships, purpose-built cruise ships, and that going down there. And it is getting a bit big now, but when I was in those early days, it was great. We had a bit of time to ourselves. We'd go on board, meet the passengers, the old barbecue and everything else, and it was good. But they don't get a lot of time to themselves now, the people at LaCroix.
So, in other words, there are so many tourists that it's beginning to get out of hand, is it?
Well, Lockroy, I'm not sure of the current figures, but 12,000 people visited Lockroy. That's an awful lot of people just visiting that small island. And they are conscious of, we did a penguin monitoring thing to make sure we were very conscious at the outset that tourists, people might say, or even other scientists, you shouldn't have people walking through in such close proximity to breeding penguins. But we've now had this project going since 1996, monitoring the success rate of the penguins. It's nothing to do with people. It's just about, the environmental, what's happening that particular season, the weather conditions and so on, where the food is. It determines the success rate of the breeding. So I've not got any problem with that at all, but it is getting very busy, certainly, and as I say, I'm glad I'm not doing it now, where you've got, there seems to be no respite from it. They've got a ship coming in the morning, a ship coming in the afternoon, more and more people, whereas when I was there, it was two ships a day. Sometimes they get a couple of days break, you can get on with some maintenance work, relax, and, it's all right.
You actually worked on the tourist ships yourself a handful of years later than you, in the early 2003, I think you were on a tourist ship.
Oh, before then.
Before then.
I did about five seasons at LaCroix, and I was ready for a break from it. And so I did have a quiet word with some of the expedition staff, expedition leaders, and said, any chance of coming to work with you? And they said, yeah, no problem at all. So that following season, it might even have been 1999, I can't remember. I did work with a couple of the companies and quite enjoyed it. And then I thought, it'd be nice to be down in Antarctica again for the millennium. And so I went down that season, and it was interesting. We were on the one big ship that's been operating down there as the Marco Polo, carries about 500-odd passengers. And it was all right, but it wasn't the same as going on the small ships. And I knew that they'd come ashore. They didn't actually land at Port La Croix because there were far too many passengers. We couldn't cope. So I'd always agreed with them. We'd operate a post office on board for them. We took all the postal equipment and everything, postage stamps on board to sell to the passengers. And it was a very lucrative business. We got, you look at the records then, and Marco Polo gave us something like 70% of our takings for that season. So, but it was hard work, and I went on board that first time, and it had been damned hard work all day, selling postage stamp and everything else. And I just wanted a break at the end of the day. I went for a walk up top, and it was one of the most stunning, beautiful evenings of the whole of the season. It was a lovely pink sky, mirror calm, the water, three minke whales swimming around the ship. There were a couple of dozen passengers walking around up top. You go down below and they've got their nightclub, the bunny girls, the croupier and everything else. And I thought, what the hell am I doing on here? I wanted to be ashore. So anyway, that 2000 season, Marco Polo, we overheard the radio, on the radio, the captain of Marco Polo talking to one of the other ships and saying, what are you doing New Year's Eve? Oh, we're going to Port La Croix and the two guys there are going to come on board and celebrate New Year with us. And I said, are we indeed? We know nothing about that. And I was damn sure I wasn't going to be spending New Year's Eve in 2000 on board the Marco Polo. I wanted to be ashore at Port La Croix with a dram in my hand, sitting in front of the fire where it was nice and quiet. And that's what we did. The captain wasn't too happy about it, apparently, declining his offer of wining and dining. But that was where I spent my New Year in 2000.
Do you feel at some point a line has to be drawn about tourism in the Antarctic? Are we getting close to that point, or...?
I don't think it will come to it. It'll find its own level, you know. It'll because of the demand and the amount of ships available and the cost involved and so on. I think it'll level out. I don't think it'll come to.
Tickets are increasing in price, aren't they?
They are increasing in price, and in fact, I've heard recently that. The National Maritime Organization is going to restrict what vessels can go down there and so on, because we've all heard of these several incidents, recent years, of ships going aground, oil spills and so on, which is a big, you know, it's a big risk, and the environmental people are well aware of what can potentially happen down there. These far bigger ships and far in, you know, greater numbers going down there. It's inevitable that these things will happen. And so organisations like the National Maritime Organisation, IARTO, the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, they've said that, you know, that they're conscious of what they're doing and what they should be taking charge of down there and so on. So I think it will, you know, it'll sort itself out, hopefully, before they actually say, right, well, that's it, governments... National governments are going to say aren't going to need to turn around and say no more. I like to think that's what will happen anyway.
So looking back over the last 40 years, nearly, of you going south, there are a couple of things to ask you about. One is about health and safety, how that's developed or changed out of all recognition, I suspect, in the Antarctic.
Oh, it has indeed, yeah. Yeah, very much so. And like all these things, it's has been a vast change since I first went down there, and we certainly wouldn't get away with doing the things we did then. We certainly wouldn't get away with it now. And I'm not so sure, as I dislike some of the things that some of the rules and regulations and, you know, this risk assessment business. I think it is just the same in this country. It's getting a bit out of hand, and everybody's been totally wrapped up in cotton wool all the time, and you know, there's got to be where's that sense of adventure? You know, there must be. We've got to leave something to a bit of spice in our life, to be able to do things and make your own decisions. And I don't altogether like. In fact, my last season at Lockroy, I said, when I was presented with the risk assessment, I didn't like it, and I said, well, you know, it's time you found somebody else to do it. To do the job, because, you know, I love life, and I'm not going to go sticking my neck out. I like to think that I can make a few decision to myself, with certainly with my experience now, and make the right decisions. And okay, accidents will happen, but it's certainly changed. We've gone a long way. Obviously, some of the things are for the good, but I do know that I enjoyed my time down those early days. And we've probably been saying this for hundreds, you know, for a long, long time now. Everybody says, oh, when I did it, it was much better, it was much more exciting, and so on. But the young people going down there today, they find it equally exciting. They don't know any difference.
But some of the young people going down are women now, of course. And Dick Laws resisted the introduction of women to the Antarctic for as long as he possibly could. Did you have a view about all that?
Do I?
Mm.
Yeah, I do have a view. It has got to happen. It is a nice atmosphere on the bases now. And, yeah, I'm all for it. It is a far more natural existence. Having said that, there was nothing wrong. My time on base with a group of lads was great, and I wouldn't want to change that. I wouldn't, you know, it was certainly too soon in those days to be taking women down, but I fully accept it, and yeah, I'm all for it now. But I certainly had my views in my younger days, to the extent I can vividly remember sitting at the bar at South Georgia with Bill Sloman and one or two others, and Bill was talking about using South Georgia as a trial base to have women on, simply because we had the facilities there, whereas other bases didn't have toilet facilities and everything else. And I can vividly remember in my innocent youth saying, well, Bill, I'm not happy with it. If there's just a couple of women on base and the fella next door to me is having a little bit every night and I'm not, it won't make me very happy, as far as my words. But it is a nice atmosphere when you've got, a reasonable balance of women to men. It's fine.
A couple more questions to mop up some details then. One is, talking about women in the Antarctic, were you there when Princess Anne went south? Were you involved in that trip?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
What was all that about?
Well, Princess Anne is a patron of the Antarctic Heritage Trust, the New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust to start with, and then the sister organisation of the UK counterpart took off in the mid-1990s. And Princess Anne agreed to be patron of that organisation as well. So she'd already been down to the New Zealand side to visit the Ross Sea Huts. And then she should have come to the peninsula it was about 5 years ago now, whatever, 4 or 5 years ago. She should have been down a couple of years previous to that, but the aircraft, the Dash 7 aircraft, had problems with that, so she didn't get down. But anyway, she went down on board HMS Endurance, flew down to the Falklands, and I can't remember what year it was. It must have been
2006,
was it? Yeah, 4 years ago. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I was asked to go on that with John Shears, the environmental officer, and the plan was for her to visit all the historic sites, which she did. She and we went in beforehand, Horseshoe Island. She had a lovely day there, and we went to Stonington, did a bit of maintenance work there. We were there for 2 or 3 days whilst Princess Anne was at Rothera. And I showed around. We showed around at Stonington and other sites, and of course Port LaCroix, which is manned by somebody else, they looked after her there. But she's a very good patron, and she does take an interest in it. And interestingly, of course, it was just about 50 years since her father, Prince Philip, had been down on the old John Biscoe and the Royal Yacht Britannia, but at birth down at Port LaCroix. And there's that lovely picture which Alan Carroll gave me, and I've got framed up at Port LaCroix of Prince Philip visiting in 1957 on the Royal Yacht.
Great. You've been to Stonington in recent years, I believe, and I wonder how you feel about it these days.
Yeah, I have. I've made probably about 3 or 4 visits to Stonington since I wintered there, and it saddens me every time I go there. I don't really think it's necessary to have the place as a historic site. Sadly, I've got very, very fond memories there. You know, I had a fantastic winter and so on. But when they closed the base down, unlike all the other bases which have been closed, they took everything out. The other bases, just all the books, everything was been left as the base had been lived in, which was lovely. But Stonington, they took everything out, including that lovely bar I talked about earlier on.
Oh, really?
It was, the idea was, and we agreed to this at the time, was that they took that bar out and it was erected at the new building at Bass Headquarters in Cambridge as part of the smoker, the coffee room, whatever. And it was a great idea, and it was taken back to Cambridge, sat there in the stores for 2 years, and eventually put on a skip, which was a tragedy. Anyway, so I go back to Stonington now, see the place just falling apart, and I wish the place was taken out altogether, I really do. It's a great shame, but unlike the other bases, which are still left, Detail Island, which is... It's an awful mess, but we can bring it back to what it was like before. Everything's in there pretty well. There's been a bit of looting taking place, you know, some of the roofing felts come off and it's very damp inside, but you still get the feel of walking in a place as it was lived in. You know, you can sort of, there's a guitar hanging up by one of the bunks and bits and pieces like that. You know, you really get that nice feel to it, whereas Stonington, it just leaves a hollow feeling in me, and it's
so. Is it worth restoring it, or is it?
No, it's really not, because no, very few people go there. It's south of the cruise ship routes. You might get the odd one ship visit every other year or something, so you can't justify. You know, the reality is the expense of doing things like that, and it's not logistically. It's not on the cards at all, and. At some stage, I think it should just be left now to decay in its own good time. But it is rather a sad sight when you go in there.
You've got two medals, haven't you, Dave? The Polar Medal and then in 1999 the Fuchs Medal. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Were you expecting them?
No, I mean, I don't think anyone's really... When you get something like that, you're not expecting them at all. And when I got the Polar Medal, the first I knew about it was the letter from... I think it's from the MOD it comes. And I think, you know, gosh, whoops of delight. I mean, it's a great honour, obviously. And I was very thrilled with that. But then to get the Fuchs Medal as well a few years later. Who was it? Bill Block phoned me up, I think, to let me know I got it. I was equally as surprised. But that was obviously just for my work with Port La Croix, what we achieved there. I'm very proud of our achievements there and what all of us did, the amount of work we put in and seeing the place now and so on.
When was the last time you were south? Was that 2006?
No, I was south just a few months ago. In January 2010 on one of the ships.
That's on a cruise ship?
On a cruise ship, yeah, doing the Falkland South Georgia Peninsula cruise. So,
are you lecturing on wildlife or on the history of the Antarctic?
History, yeah. Yeah, but I don't lecture, I just give talks. I'm not very good at lecturing. In fact, I think I'm the only lecturer now in Antarctica who's still showing slides. I'm not into modern technology. But it seems to go down quite well. They, when you're showing old pictures like that, slides come over equally as well as a PowerPoint-type projection thing. But people enjoy it. Okay, I'm not a scientist or anything, and I never claim to be. But just having that first-hand knowledge of the places we're going to and can give a few tales. I think it does mean a lot to the ordinary passengers going down there. And, you know, certainly at the end of the cruise, they always reflect their, you know, what they've, how much they've enjoyed my talks.
Is there something about the people who tour, become tourists in the Antarctic? Is there a common factor? Are they the same people who go to Venice and Blenheim Castle and Paris and Eiffel Tower?
I think... Yeah, good question. I think they are, you know, obviously people who enjoy travelling. Some of them, no doubt, you do get some of the people who just get the, where can we go next year, get the pin out and stick it in the map, oh, we're going there routine. But I think the biggest majority of people are genuinely interested in the wildlife, in going to remote places, and certainly, you know, seeing a new part of the world and the romance of Antarctica, polar regions and so on. So they're not generally your ordinary run-of-the-mill tourists.
Interesting people?
Yeah, lots of them are. Very interesting. Really interesting. You should interview some of them. Yeah, they are. You get people who, famous people and and so on. Yeah, they are interesting. Everybody, from your ordinary folks to your film stars and so on. I've met some very interesting people.
Do you plan to retire?
Well, I'm retired now, as good as.
From going south, yeah.
I mean, it's been getting a little bit... When I'm down there doing it, I do enjoy it, but it'd be nice, I think, and I've been saying I'll give this next season a miss, but I certainly hope to be going down again, you know, for years to come, but not necessarily quite so much as I've been doing, because there are other things I want to be doing. I've got this narrowboat, and I'm just not getting time to use it, and... I'm back with our local mountaineering club and I want to be out weekends with them and, you know, just missed a fantastic winter season up here in Scotland and so on. So, yeah, so I shan't be retiring for a bit. I shall be going down again.
That's good.
It's interesting, actually, when I can vividly remember sailing out of South Georgia on the John Biscoe when I had that first season, and I'm a bit soppy like this, but I did actually, again, had a lump in my throat as we sailed out from King Edward Point. And then suddenly something said to me, "Oh, don't be so silly, you'll be back again." And I was, and I've been going back again ever since. And I do love it.
Dave, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.